This talk is going to take us back a few days to Monday. So there's some more talks about bubble nucleation and false vacuum decay on Monday. So I'm a bit of a throwback in that sense. So what I want to talk about today is work that Kate and Ian, who both talked on Monday, have had a huge part in. And also Andrew Grozek, who's a postdoc of mine, who's now at University of Queensland, collaborated on some of this work. And what I want to tell you about is some of the work we've done on simulating false vacuum decay at finite temperature. So bubble nucleation in thermal gases. So why is this an interesting question? Well, one can ask the basic question, what happens if you try and do an analog vacuum decay experiment, but it's not exactly at zero temperature? So instead you have a supercooled system that's stuck in a metastable state over here, but it's not at zero temperature. In some sense, this is unavoidable. You're never going to get your experiment all the way down to T equals zero. So in that sense, it's an interesting question to know what happens if it's not, because that's what we're going to see. I think it's still of interest as an early universe analog. So what if there is some temperature? We don't exactly expect that the temperature was necessarily zero. And it's also interesting in itself to study bubble nucleation and then bubble dynamics in the presence of thermal excitations. So a bubble moving through a thermal system. And I'll come back to that comment at the end of the talk. So what am I going to go through? So the first part of the talk, I want to introduce and explain some of the methods that we use to model these systems at finite temperature, and talk about why we think these are good models to use. And then I'll talk through our applications to bubble nucleation, so the meat of the talk really goes in the middle there. And then I'll end with a bit of an outlook for ways that we could improve our simulations and things that we'd like to study in the future. So I'll start with some background on how we do our modeling. And I should say, so I come at this from the side of someone who is not a cosmologist, but has done some modeling in the past of finite temperature Bose-Einstein condensate experiments. And the first thing you do if you have a Bose-Einstein condensate experiment to model is you think, well, can I use the Gross-Potevsky equation, which we heard a lot about on Monday? And if you're lucky, you can, and everything's very simple, and it works. And what's surprising sometimes is how well it works and how hard you have to go to do something with a BEC that takes you out of the Gross-Potevsky regime. But lots of effort over the years in theory has been put into thinking about what are the next steps beyond this. And I've made a little bit of a map. I wouldn't take this as a complete map. It's more of a sketch on the back of a napkin kind of map. But the basic ways you can go is you can say, well, I'll assume that my cloud is mostly condensed, so I've got a condensate mode in there, and then I've got some other stuff, and take a perturbative approach. So say the other stuff is small and start to expand. And there are various tricks that you can use to try and get better descriptions of the condensate coupled to some non-condensate component of your gas. These may be deterministic, or you may go down a stochastic route. So the simplest thing you might think to do is just add some Langevin-like stochastic noise to the Gross-Potevsky equation. And what we're going to end up doing is not all that different from that. So what I'm going to mainly talk about today is how we get at something called a projected stochastic Gross-Potevsky equation. Sorry, a stochastic projected Gross-Potevsky equation, which is very similar to just adding some noise, but there are some subtleties that I want to go through. This approach is slightly different in that we haven't just added noise, we've decided to separate our system into the highly occupied bosonic degrees of freedom, which we'll call our system. So that's our Bose gas, and treat some of the rest of the system as just a thermal bath that we don't want to worry about the microscopic details of. An alternative approach, so in red over here, I will not be talking about today. So an alternative approach is to have a detailed model of your thermal cloud and couple that to the equation of motion for your condensate and let your thermal cloud have its own dynamics. So a Boltzmann equation for quantum particles. In principle, you could do something down in this corner of the diagram here, where you have a nice division of your system into system and bath, and you also have a quantum Boltzmann equation for a dynamical thermal cloud. And you can go back and read papers from about 2008 on these approaches, where people said, I'm sure we'll do that soon. And no one's done that yet, so here be dragons. We won't be going there either today. So by way of a bit more introduction, let me just go through two more slides on this, because I think it's an interesting point to think about. So very often one thinks of the philosophy of the Gross-Potevsky equation as saying, well, I have my field operator for my quantum field, my many-body quantum field in second quantized formulation, and I can always think of the GPE as just being, I'm saying there's one macroscopically occupied mode that nearly all the particles are in, and I'll just pretend that that's the whole system. And if you put this, you ignore the rest, put this into the Heisenberg equations of motion, you get back the Gross-Potevsky equation. And so your interpretation of what you're doing is that your classical field psi is describing the one highly occupied mode of the single body density matrix that you have of your gas. Okay. The approach I'm going to take, and that we take in this modeling, is slightly different. So instead we say, I can expand my field operator over a series of modes. We'll work with bosons in a box today, so these are just plane wave modes. If I expand over a set of plane wave modes, that's a fairly trivial step, and I can trivially put in some cutoff momentum here where I split my sum into two terms. So I say, there's some momentum at which I'm gonna do different things. And we don't need to worry about what that is yet. I'm gonna get there in a couple of slides. So below the cutoff, we say, let's assume everything's highly occupied. So our mode occupations are gonna be larger than one. And we have bosons, so we can fit many of them in a mode. And let's replace our creation our annihilation operators with complex numbers. So that becomes a classical field. Above the cutoff, we don't want to do that because we can't assume high occupation. So instead, you have to do something different. And behind the scenes, because I won't be going through all the equations in detail, but what you can do here is just describe things by a single particle Wigner function and assume you have incoherent particles. So that's the trick, treat these parts of the system differently. If you do the very simple division and you just throw this away altogether, well, all those words I used about having a different interpretation still yields essentially the same result. We get back the Gross-Potevsky equation if we ignore the incoherent bath. But we have gained something, which is this projector, which is telling us that we must work in this space of modes below the cutoff momentum where the occupation numbers we expect to be high so that we can replace a quantum field with a classical field. And our interpretation of our results changes. So we aren't describing just one highly occupied mode of the single particle density matrix. We have to think of our classical field equations that we're solving here as being something that's giving us an approximation to all of the highly occupied modes. There may be more than one. So it doesn't have to be all the condensate in one mode. There's all the highly occupied modes of the system should be correctly described. Ah, correctly. To some approximation, to well described. Okay. So you can go through this process and keep the bath. So that was on the previous slide, we just threw away the incoherent particles. Instead, you can choose to keep them. And you get a theory. that ends up being a theory of trajectory dynamics in a stochastic projected Gross-Potevsky equation. So to the projected Gross-Potevsky equation we had on the previous slide, we have a canonical, a grand canonical bath of particles with some chemical potential and some temperature, which are inputs to our model. And as I've said, we don't have any dynamics of the thermal clouds, so they're just fixed. So we choose a mu and a t, and we simulate. And this coupling between the incoherent region and the coherent region dynamics adds noise and damping terms. And this is the stochastic projected Gross-Potevsky equation. So we have an incoherent region and a C-field region. Okay, so let's go through these terms in order. Happily, the first term is a nice Hamiltonian term. So this is just the projected Gross-Potevsky equation. So we have a Hamiltonian evolution of the classical field. The next set of terms we find are fairly simple noise and damping terms that represent particle exchange with our reservoir, with our thermal bath. We have a noise and a damping term. So this represents interactions with the reservoir where we exchange particles. What we also have and can derive are terms that represent number conserving scattering processes. I'll say more about these at the end of the talk, but from now until I mention them again at the end, we're going to ignore these terms because these terms are very difficult to implement. So the simplest thing to do is not worry about them too much. And that's generally what's been done when using this set of equations to model bosons and condensates at finite temperature. So taking the first two terms only then, to refer back to what I said earlier, aside from the projector, this is kind of a quote unquote obvious thing to do because we've added noise terms and damping terms to our Gross-Potevsky equation. And we've done it in a way that you see we have a gamma term. This is the damping rate that we're introducing. It's appearing both in our noise and in our damping. So there's a fluctuation dissipation theorem that this obeys. And so this temperature comes into the strength of the noise relative to the strength of the damping. Okay. But I would argue that the advantage of going through the formalism of projecting into a system plus a bath means that we've got a projector on this system, and it means our noise is defined in a nice principled way. So we aren't trying to add noise at infinitely high wave numbers. We know where we should cut off our grid and stop adding more UV noise. Okay. So another question I promised to come back to is where to put the cutoff. So what you want to do is think, well, where is this place where I can start saying that occupations of modes are high compared to one? Well, you can just temporarily think about ignoring the interactions in your gas. You're going to have a Bose-Einstein distribution at some temperature T. And we want to put the cutoff near where this this occupation number is becoming one. So we want to describe these modes down here classically, and we're describing these modes up here, which have small occupations, by the thermal bath, so the noise terms. And this is the point where, of course, the Bose-Einstein distribution starts to look like a Rayleigh-Jeans distribution when you get into the infrared. And so this approach of treating the infrared as a classical field is very much like saying we're just treating the Rayleigh-Jeans part. Obviously, when you add the interactions in, it's not going to be Rayleigh-Jeans anymore. But this is where the interactions between bosons, the mod psi squared term, kind of lives. And a philosophy very much like this you can use to calculate things like what is the BKT transition temperature in a 2D Bose gas. The philosophy of this calculation is very similar to this. So you do a classical field simulation in the infrared, and you match on the Hamiltonian mode that I described by the Einstein distribution. Okay. So that's a bit about the description that we're going to use. What sort of things? So obviously the description is approximate. And I've said that we're going to ignore some of the scattering terms as well. So what gives us some confidence that this is a good description to use for phase transition phenomena? So it's been used an awful lot in the context of second order phase transitions. We heard a talk that mentioned the Kibble-Zurich mechanism already on Monday. But to go through it briefly, extremely briefly, Kibble-Zurich mechanism describes defect formation as we cross through a second order phase transition in a finite time. So we can imagine a process where we take a system that's at some very high temperature and has lots of defects in it, and we do is above the BEC transition altogether, indeed. And we do a quench. So we quench the temperature, or alternatively, we quench the chemical potential. We can do that by just changing the parameters of our bath in this stochastic model. And we can do that quickly or slowly. And if we do it quickly, we expect to form lots of domains with defects, topological defects between them. If we do it slowly, we expect to be able to form larger domains with fewer defects. And there should be a scaling law for the defect number where it goes with the quench time as a power law. That's the prediction of the Kibble-Zurich mechanism. I won't say too much more about that, but what the things that I will say is this picture corresponds very nicely to this stochastic formalism. So we have a stochastic equation. We have to run a whole ensemble of stochastic trajectories. In every trajectory, you see a different set of defects appearing, depending on whether you quench fast or quench slow, and then you average to find the average behavior over your ensemble of trajectories that you're running. So these stochastic classical field methods are a good way to explore dynamics of these phase transitions. And overall, I would say they've had a lot of success. So here are some papers on spontaneous formation of vortices as you go through the BEC transition, and spontaneous formation of vortices, again, in an elongated BEC this time. As you go from a thermal gas to an equilibrated BEC at finite temperature. So in general, you can get good fits to experiment from using the stochastic model. There's a small caveat to that that I wish to add. So in theory, I mentioned earlier there's this damping rate in our model, this damping rate gamma. And in theory, at equilibrium, you can predict what this should be a priori. And it has a complicated dependence on what you choose as the cutoff for your gas. So when we put this cutoff in, that sets what we really ought to set gamma to if we believe we're in equilibrium at that temperature. And this gamma turns out to come out very small from the a priori calculation. So I'm only aware, there may be others, but the only one I'm aware of is one paper where a match was found between the a priori gamma rate and experimental results. So here, no fitted parameters essentially go into modeling the experiment with the stochastic projected Gross-Potevsky equation. And this experiment was studying formation of persistent currents in toroidal traps. But in general, you can get very nice fits, but you have to let gamma vary. And generally, what I'm talking about here is non-equilibrium experiments. So to get a good fit to your non-equilibrium dynamics, in general, people have had to think about varying gamma away from the equilibrium value to get a good match. Okay, so with all that said, I'll move on to the actual bubble formation now. So that's a lot about the model. So what have we done with this model? So as I said, we use the simple growth SPGPE. So we have thrown away those scattering terms that we don't like. And we've studied a variety of models. And first I'm going to talk about the model that was proposed quite some time ago of false vacuum decay by Fialco and other co-workers, which is in a BEC that's in spread across two hyperfine states of a spin 1 BEC. So there can be coupling between the two components. So the atoms can be moved between the two. And we've looked at, as in Alex's talk on Monday, he explained that in this model there's a time-dependent driver. And we've looked at both the case where we include the time-dependent driving and the case where we average over the time-dependent driving. And we looked at different ways of crossing this transition. So the interesting thing that we need to do with our stochastic Gross-Potofsky model is we choose mu and a T, so the temperature, and first we want to thermalize our system, and then we want to watch what happens with bubble formation. So first we need to thermalize. So there are two ways we've tried doing this. So one is just raising a very high barrier around our metastable state, so that tunneling would take a very, very long time, so we can let our simulation thermalize itself in the metastable state, and then lower the barrier and watch the decay. An alternative that we've also looked at is actually switching the vacua. So thermalizing in the ground state at some phase, and then changing the parameters of the system quickly so that the false and the true vacuum swap around. It doesn't really, you get very similar results however you do this. It turns out to be fairly straightforward to get the system to thermalize and then change the parameters so that you can observe the decay. Two coupled hyperfine states. So just to explain what we have, so our psi here is a spinner field. There's two internal components. And in the time averaged picture, this is what the Hamiltonian looks like. So we have some interaction terms. We also have terms that are a consequence of the external driving that's coupling the hyperfine levels. So that's where our sigma operators, our Pauli matrices are coming from. And this Hamiltonian, we then model the evolution with a stochastic projected Gross-Potofsky equation. So we have our projector, we have our damping term, we have our noise term, and this V is the potential from over here. I've moved to dimensionless units on the right, whereas we had the dimensions on the left. So these are the equations that we have to solve. And again, just to summarize, what was mentioned in Alex's talk the other day. So it's not obvious what we're talking about with the false vacuum here, but if we consider a uniform state where the psi 1 component and the psi 2 component have some relative phase phi here, we can ask in this state, so with constant densities, what does the potential look like as a function of phi? And this is where we find there is a false vacuum and a true vacuum. So we want to initialize our gas in a state where, on average, the relative phase is pi, and but obviously with the thermal fluctuations at the temperature we're interested in studying. So we do that, and then at time zero, we make a change. So we lower the barrier in this case, and we watch the system decay. And here are the examples where you see time goes from left to right. This is in one dimension, so space goes up and down, and you can see that our fluctuations can form bubbles, which then grow at the speed of sound in the system, roughly. And occasionally we form more than one bubble and then they collide. Sometimes it takes a very long time to form a bubble.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
On the bottom panel, the middle bubble looks strange. Do you have an explanation why it's not starting from a cone?
From a point. No, I don't have a good explanation. That's a point I'm going to come back to at the end.
Have you seen more of that?
I'm not sure. We see... I wouldn't like to give a comment on exactly how many look like that versus how many don't.
Might be because it's wedged in between bubbles.
So that is the point I'm going to come back to at the end, actually, yeah. So is there an effect where bubbles are more likely to nucleate nearer other bubbles is something we want to explore.
A quick question on that point. So the bubble just above it, where you've kind of got the intersection of bubble walls, is that then a bubble nucleating in between two bubble walls? Which is that related to what you were just saying about it? Maybe it's more likely to happen there? Because it looks like...
Is it where I'm putting the laser
yes,
pointer?
Yes, yeah, exactly yeah, there, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so why are we getting some sort of a bounce here? Yeah, okay, so all of these dynamics in general, maybe I'll just skip ahead to my Outlook part. I think there's a lot of interesting things going on when bubbles collide. Mm. And with it, are in the region around a bubble wall, are we more likely to nucleate another bubble? I think those are really interesting questions. And no, I don't have a good answer at the moment. Right, Alex.
Are these all different runs for the same parameters, or do the little colored bars indicate some difference?
The colored bars are for the next slide, but the parameters are all the same here. This is just a stochastic difference. Yep.
Thanks.
Okay. So I'll move on to the next slide. So, No, there we go. So the colored bars just relate to which line on the next slide is describing which simulation. So what we want to do, so what we want to study, what I'm working towards here is what's the bubble nucleation rate. So to do that, we have to process lots of runs. So only a few are shown here. In reality, we do up to thousands of runs. And what we look for is what fraction of the system has transferred into the true vacuum state. And we set a threshold. So when the average value of cos phi in the system has reached minus 0.8, we say, OK, that's where it's definitely crossed and a bubble is now forming. And we can plot statistics of the survival probability. So after a given time in all our simulations, what fraction of our simulations haven't got a bubble yet? OK? And so that's going down and down and down and down, and we can fit the exponential decay that is predicted for this to occur. And that gives us data. And then we can look at fitting to the instanton prediction for this. So this is a thermal instanton calculation, which predicts there should be a prefactor and some exponent beta, B, sorry. So prefactor A naught, exponent B. What we can do is we can do two different things. So one thing we can do is only allow to fit the prefactor. And so that's what you see when you have the dashed curves here, are allowing only prefactor fitting. So that means no renormalization effects of the noise on lambda. And so the fits, some of the fits are more reasonable than others there, but the dependence is generally going the right way. If we also allow some fitting in the exponent, which we would, the argument to justify with that would be renormalization effects compared to the bare instanton calculation, we can get the dotted lines, which then agree with the data extremely well. Okay. So to mention a couple of the other things that we've looked at with this modeling. So I mentioned all of what I've showed you on the previous slides was in the time-averaged version of this model. There was a discussion on Monday that really you have to have in this model a time-dependent modulation of the RF coupling field, and that potentially leads to parametric instabilities and issues. So we also studied within this stochastic model, is there a point where the damping in the model eliminates these sort of problems? So we choose parameters for the driving where there is a parametric instability issue, and we try cranking up the dissipation to see how that changes. And if you make the dissipation high enough, then indeed you can make these parametric instabilities go away. You can shuffle them. You can make them go away, but you have to choose a very high gamma to do this, much, much higher than the a priori value. So I don't want to go into that in too much detail. The other thing we looked at is if there are possible problems with this parametric instability, are there other analog ways to do an analog vacuum decay in a Bose gas experiment. And we looked at a spin one system. So here are just some brief results from the two-dimensional simulations of a spin one system, which Kate just talked about in her talk on Monday. And here, instead of just occupying two of the hyperfine ground states, we're allowing the system to occupy all three. The structure of the false and the true vacuum become a bit more complicated, and we have to introduce a coupling with a Raman transition to one of the excited state manifolds. However, we don't have to modulate any of the couplings in time, so we don't have this flow K issue. And again, we do 2D simulations. Obviously, the 2D simulations are more demanding, which is the reason why you see slightly wider looking error bars on these points. And here we fit prefactor and exponent, again, of the instanton, the thermal instanton, to our data. So we fit both, but we find that within the 95% confidence interval on the fitting, the exponents actually match the instanton prediction. So they're consistent with not having to renormalize at all. Consistent with. They don't, you know, they agree within that error bar. So that is that. I'm coming to the end. So I want to talk about what we want to do next. This was commented on as we went through. So this is one of the things we're interested in. What is going on when bubbles are colliding with each other? What's happening with bubble collisions? These are some images from the spin one two-dimensional case, where we see a large growing bubble, and we see this bubble has sort of appeared on the side of it. If there's nothing else I've learned this week, I've learned a new term, which is that these are apparently called barnacles. So do our bubbles have barnacles? Is an interesting question that we can now go away and look at. Another model which I haven't described, but Ian talked about on Monday, is a ferromagnetic sort of analog model of vacuum decay. And Ian showed a video, this is a still from the video, where we see a bubble wall, we see formation of these half-quantized vortices in a pseudo-spinner-half context. So we are interested in what are these defects that can appear and whether there are barnacles on our bubbles. What are we planning to do next? Well, as we look more, you know, so far we've focused very much on these rates and comparing to the instanton predictions. But there's a lot more we can do when we have all the real-time dynamics of the bubbles compared to just an instanton calculation. And these are the sorts of things we want to look at. But of course, this is the very non-equilibrium stuff where I gave my warning earlier that we've ignored some of the scattering terms in the stochastic projected Gross-Pisevsky equation that you would get if you derive it from first principles. So these extra terms are potentially relevant to this sort of dynamics. So what we'd like to do is explore the dynamics, but also explore, are these terms important for describing these dynamics around the bubble walls and things? And they're harder to I said they were harder to implement. Let me justify that. So instead of additive noise, we now have multiplicative noise with some strange correlations rather than just white noise. And we have an odd-looking non-local potential to compute. So the numerics will be harder, but we aspire to try and implement these terms and see how they affect things. Because much as I made an analogy to the second-order transitions in the Kibble-Zurek mechanism, where the simple growth version has proved quite effective, nonetheless, there is one paper where this has been studied with added scattering terms, and added scattering terms were found to change some of the exponents in a Kibble-Zurek quench. So there is some evidence that these extra terms can change things you see in the non-equilibrium dynamics, so I think it's an interesting question to try and add them and see how they affect our bubble nucleation. So with that, I'll leave the conclusions on that slide. So we've introduced the stochastic projected Gross-Pushevsky equation. I hope what I've said has been helpful for your understanding of exactly what modeling we're doing of these systems. I've explained what we found in our investigations of vacuum decay at finite temperature in a range of analogs, and where we've found good agreement with the instanton calculations, but the outlook is to try and look at more than just the rate. So what happens with bubble mergers, what happens with correlations between where we form bubbles, are bubbles bunched, and do we have barnacles? And the scattering terms may be important for that. So thanks very much for your attention.
Hey, thank you, and I'm holding the microphone. I'm going to completely take advantage of that and ask the first questions. So I have two comments and a question.
Cool.
Comment number one, Dalila has a beautiful plot in her paper that she didn't get to show in her talk, where we looked at the whole space-time correlation function of bubble nucleation sites. And you do have a clustering of extra probability to nucleate bubbles near other bubbles, not just at equal times, but also along the whole trajectory.
Okay, great.
So that's a prediction, and cool if you see that. Comment number two, you should look back even to Ian's old work where they talked a lot about what happens when bubbles collide. And then there is a bizarre subsector of literature where people were really interested in finding the observational consequences of bubble collisions in the multiverse. And we also thought tons and tons about what happens when bubbles collide. So
yeah,
it looks like it should. Cool.
Be good to join those up. Yeah.
Question. What do we trust as, you know, you get these ensembles, like, it doesn't really look like that because we can't measure all those things, right? So the thing we trust is kind of ensemble averages of things we can actually observe. So just in your opinion, like, what are the limitations on using this as a tool for finding out what the dynamics actually looks like?
So that's a good question. So one thing that's very attractive about these stochastic methods is you get trajectories. And you can say, well, if I run my experiment once, maybe that's the same as doing one trajectory. And that is a dangerous assumption to make, right? That's not really what's true. So what's true is the averages. So for instance, with the bub, you know, the pictures are nice and the pictures are a great guide, but you need to look at correlations over your whole ensemble between bubbles to try, you know, are bubbles coming off the sides? Unless you can get it as a statistical average, there's a question over whether it's really true. Yeah, if that answers the question.
Yeah, no, just get your perspective. That's good.
Hi, I may just have misunderstood. It looked like both with your instanton and also from your diagrams, as though you see this as tunneling from one of these to the one vacuum to the other. On the other hand, this is at finite temperature. Isn't it much more likely that the finite temperature just bumps the thing up to a high enough energy that it just, there is no barrier anymore and it just falls into the other well?
Yeah, so the temperature should be low enough that we don't expect that to happen, right? So the energy scale of the temperature should be lower than the height of the barrier, so half kBT.
Right away, so yeah.
Yeah, so you know, you can...
Sorry?
No.
I mean, the temperature takes a while to bump, you know. You can start off with a bunch of stuff at lower, but then it gets bumped up by the environment and goes over the top. So, you know, it's like shaking a can with, you know, or your coffee cup. It doesn't necessarily spill over the edges right away. It's just sometimes the randomness finally dumps it over. So.
Okay. But I think the thing there is you wouldn't have an instanton solution anymore, right? Well, so we match to the instanton solution, and that suggests that we're doing the right thing. That we're seeing, you know, it's you're at a finite temperature, but it is tunneling through some part of the barrier, right?
I mean, I think the instanton is this particular instanton you're using is describing what you are asking, Bill. Just the probability of getting a bunch of random field configurations. This is the probability you get the right random field configuration that does what you say, spills it over the top.
Okay.
Okay.
Certainly no expert.
I have a couple of questions, if I may. So thanks for the really nice talk. So I'm curious about the thing you said about there's only one experiment where they managed to match the gamma, this dissipation rate, and you were saying that's kind of because maybe you don't know how to calculate it a priori if you're not in equilibrium. Is that right?
Yes.
Is that what you said?
There's only one that I'm aware of.
Okay. I was curious about, so yeah, if you're really strongly like non-equilibrium, is it even a good way of thinking about it to have gamma being a constant? Or could you be like changing the properties of your thermal cloud over time and so gamma becomes like a time-dependent thing?
Yeah, sure. So this is one of the reasons why having a dynamical thermal cloud would be great.
Right.
Take the Kibble-Zurek scenario and you're going to do a quench. Mm-hmm. You're going to quench from one mu and t to the other mu and t, right? You can change your parameters in time, right? But it's not always clear when you're in non-equilibrium, you know, what should the cutoffs should change, right? This is what, so you have mu1, t1, going to mu2, t2. Mm-hmm. And there's a good prescription for choosing the cutoff and gamma at equilibrium at either end.
Yeah.
But how should it be changing in the middle? That's a deficiency of the method, but there's no good answer to that.
Yeah.
You would need to get into the here be dragons corner.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Yeah.
I guess I was wondering that because in this setting, that's kind of the picture you have, right? You start in something that looks kind of like equilibrium in the false vacuum, and you have some kind of really non-equilibrium thing where you tunnel and you create a bunch of bubbles that collide, and then you kind of end up with a equilibrium true vacuum thing.
Mm-hmm.
So is it a good way of thinking about it to have gamma being constant all the way through? Is that right? That's what you do?
Gamma constant the whole way through because that's the simplest thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, one other thing I didn't mention, of course, is we do check, you know, if you change gamma, can you get the same curves?
Mm-hmm.
And you can still, the fit is just as good, but it changes the prefactor. So if you change gamma by a factor of 2,
mm-hmm.
You do change the rate, but it's just a prefactor scaling. Yeah.
Okay. That brings me on to the other thing I wanted to ask, if that's okay, was about the renormalization. So I was curious. So with the spin half system, you do have to renormalize the bit that goes in the exponent, but you didn't with your spin one system. Is that right?
Yes.
My question was kind of, why do you think that is? And then also with the renormalization that you do with the spin half system, whether the amount of renormalization you have to do as you change lambda, whether that kind of goes the way you'd expect it to, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, okay. I think the numbers we'd have to discuss more in detail, but we had to renormalize less for spin one, and I don't know why.
Okay.
Thanks.
We'll go here next, and if the green microphone could make its way to the next question.
Yeah, it was a follow-up on that question. So in the case where you had to do less renormalization, was the temperature higher by any chance?
I think the temperatures are a similar order.
Okay.
I think.
Is there any way that could be more related to Bill's concern that, you know, that is a setting in which actually you slosh over the barrier rather than tunnel?
So I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure I've understood the question right about this. Sorry. So
okay, we can discuss maybe afterwards.
Okay, last question up here.
Yeah. Okay. Just a quick comment about the gamma factors. They're generally frequency dependent in interacting systems that have just modes that can dissipate freely with another, for instance, a bath. You can also model them in non-equilibrium interacting cases, and you might get behavior that more closely matches between theoretical prediction and the data.
Okay.
Because, I mean, fluctuation dissipation is a it's true, away from equilibrium as well, right?
I'm not quite sure what you're saying, sorry.
Oh, I'm just saying you should expect that your gammas aren't constant
in time,
based on what interaction and what process you're considering. And
sure,
then use
sure.
the process itself to adjust your gammas and see how they're changing, because they get basically renormalized when you have an interaction. It induces a transformation of the
you're not saying there's a way I should calculate how I change them in time, right?
I'm just saying you can if you want. I mean,
yeah.
If you're saying
yes.
You're not seeing good agreement and you're saying what's happening.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks.
Okay, well, let's thank our speaker again. Thank you.